Hi, I'm Todd Barry. This is The Takeaway for Wednesday, March 15th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick in for John Hockenberry today, and we thank you for joining us. We begin this hour in and around Africa in some of the poorest countries in the region. New reports warn that famine is taking hold in several countries. Those include Somalia, Yemen, South Sudan, parts of Nigeria, and Kenya. Now, many of those countries are at war. Those wars cripple economies, and they make it hard to produce and distribute food. They also entangle aid efforts, because warring factions often use food crises for leverage. At the same time, though, crippling drought has returned to the region, and it's an awful reminder of how things were just a few years ago. Famine tore through Somalia in 2010, killed up to 300,000 people at that time. Then, just last week, 110 Somalis, mostly women and children, died of starvation within one two-day period. The United Nations has a very specific definition of famine, but by the time it's declared, people are already dying in large numbers in most cases. The UN says that more than 20 million people are now facing or at risk of famine, creating one of the most urgent humanitarian periods since the UN was created after the Second World War. Mohamed Al-Assadi is communications specialist for UNICEF Yemen, and he says from Sana'a that the daily reality there is desperate.
Being a Yemeni and walking in the street of Sana'a, I can just clearly see layers of suffering in the eyes of people. People are desperate, people are hopeless, and they are afraid of tomorrow. They are afraid to see another day of suffering or to see their children dying out of hunger.
Kieran Donnelly is Senior Vice President for International Programs at the International Rescue Committee, and he joins me now in the studio. Kieran, welcome.
Thank you.
Let's talk about Yemen, and we unfortunately have to talk about several other countries as well. Is famine in Yemen really just a function of that civil war that's been grinding for so many years?
Famine in Yemen is a function of three things, and this is common across a number of countries in Africa right now. It's a combination of drought and declining agricultural production, economic decline and even collapse in the Yemeni situation, and the effects of the conflict on the civilian population, on the delivery infrastructure for aid, and on the economy itself.
In the context of the war that we've been reporting so much on this show and elsewhere, what are the prospects for intervention or aid in a place like Yemen, where warring factions are at it on a daily basis?
Well, it's extremely difficult to deliver aid under those circumstances. The IRC is on the ground in Yemen and across Africa responding to the current food insecurity crisis. We work heavily through local staff, but when you're dealing with warring factions, when you're dealing with moving front lines, when you're dealing with indiscriminate attacks from the air, it's very dangerous to be able to deliver aid. The longer the famine situations, food insecurity continue, the more those numbers increase, the harder it becomes to deliver, and it becomes a vicious cycle, which is only going to see more and more people continue to suffer and driven into famine conditions without an urgent upscale in the humanitarian intervention.
This vicious cycle that you mentioned is also at work in South Sudan. Now, this is a country that's been in front of the world's eyes for many, many years, is now on the brink of famine once again. Can you describe conditions there at the moment?
South Sudan is squarely in the focus of our emergency response efforts at the IRC at the moment. There are 5 million people in need of humanitarian assistance. 3.8 million of those are food insecurity. Just a couple of weeks ago, we had a formal declaration of famine in a number of counties in South Sudan. That means in those areas, 30% of children under 5 years of age are suffering from severe and acute malnutrition.
And we should drill down on that a little bit, because famine is a term that might not be well understood by a lot of people. It actually has a very specific definition. It doesn't just mean hunger.
That's right. Famine is considered level 5 in what we call the IPC classification, Integrated Food Security Classification System. It's the worst of the 5 levels. And in simple terms, when we talk about there being famine, we mean there is evidence of destitution, starvation, and death at a significant level in a specific area or in a specific population group.
Now, in Somalia, Kieran Donnelly, there are reports of people dying of starvation even just this very week. Is there anything in place that can prevent a return of this awful reality that Somalia's already experienced?
The concern in Somalia is declining cereal productions, declining livestock and agricultural productivity, coupled with the drought that we've talked about already. is going to drive purchasing power parity for communities back to levels that we saw in 2010, 2011. So people are going to be in the same situations, unable to provide for themselves, unable to provide for their families, and that's going to drive the kind of acute malnutrition. There is an aid infrastructure on the ground. The IRC was one of the first organizations to begin responding to this crisis back in October of last year. But the scale-up hasn't been sufficient. The resources are not sufficient, and the access to communities, particularly in areas that are insecure, which unfortunately is still the case in large parts of Somalia, is still very challenging.
So a couple of the countries that we've talked about so far, Yemen and Somalia, are on the Trump administration's list of countries that are included in our famous travel ban. And I don't want to draw too much of a connection here where maybe there isn't one, but it seems to me if Americans are now thinking of places like Yemen and Sudan in the context of terrorism, they might understand that worsening drought, worsening famine, and a lack of food leads to instability, which usually gets you more terrorists, not less.
I think that's a real danger, that if people perceive themselves to be alienated, to be sidelined, that that's going to drive them towards extremists. It's also going to increase migration and displacement across borders. So the migration crisis that we're very concerned about is only going to worsen if we're not able to address these humanitarian needs. We need more resources and we need the access to be able to deliver them. We need it urgently.
Kieran Donnelly is Senior Vice President for International Programs at the International Rescue Committee. Thank you for joining us, Kieran.
Thank you for having me.
We want to continue our discussion of hunger now, but this is hunger of a different kind. Right here at home in the United States, college campuses are not places where you would probably expect to find hunger and homelessness, but that's increasingly become a problem for people who are cash-strapped but still trying to get an education.
It's heartbreaking, sometimes devastating, especially when you don't know, when you're not just thinking of you, but when you're going to provide for the ones that you have. Sometimes you beat yourself up because you try to think back as to what did you do, what I didn't do.
You're listening there to Diane McManus, and she's a mother and student at Bunker Hill Community College in Boston. She told WGBH's higher education desk that she's sometimes so hungry she can't even focus on her studies. Now, the results of a new survey out today show that Diane McManus is not alone. Far from it. About 33,000 students at 70 community colleges around the country were surveyed for this report. Two-thirds of them reported that they struggle with food insecurity, and one-half of them with housing insecurity. There are people like this first-year student at Bunker Hill who didn't want to use her real name.
Homelessness is, it feels like being on a yo-yo. Sometimes you can afford it, and then any little thing can make you unable to afford it.
Sarah Goldrick-Rabb is one of the authors of that new report on hunger and homelessness at community colleges in the United States. It was produced by the Wisconsin Hope Lab, which she also founded. Sarah Goldrick-Rabb, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, I know you can't talk about any of the specific voices that we just heard about in that intro there, but did those stories that you heard sound typical? Are they indicative of the types of people that you encountered during the study?
Unfortunately, yes. They sound very, very familiar. I've spent most of the last decade studying community college students and students at public universities around the country. And while I expected to hear stories about people who couldn't buy laptops or books, I increasingly started hearing the sorts of stories that you just listened to. People who can't afford enough to eat, people who can't afford a regular roof over their heads or a place to sleep at night. It's pretty heartbreaking.
Well, previous studies have suggested that half of community college students are food insecure. Your study upgrades that to 2 out of 3. That's a staggering number. What's typical with a student who's classified as food insecure? What's going on here in their lives?
Well, you know, I mean, the first thing is I think that we find higher rates of food insecurity possibly because we got this survey to students earlier in the semester. And one of the things that is typical for students who were going through these challenges is they don't even make it very far within the term, meaning that they may be enrolled in September, but if you wait to talk to them until November, they're gone. These folks are really on the knife's edge of poverty, and it's why they're in college. They're doing exactly what they can and should to try to get ahead, but being hungry while trying to master college-level material, it's tough.
1 in 7 people in your study were classified as homeless, which is another staggering number. And here they are trying to go to school, obviously, to be able to make more money and better these very conditions in the first place.
That's right. I want to be clear, you know, I ate ramen in college, and I'm sure that some of your listeners did as well. And some of us even sort of couch surfed in the nice sense of that. This isn't that. These are folks that can't even afford ramen. They're not sure where their next meal's coming from at all. You know, when we say somebody's homeless, it's not that they can't decide where to stay at night. It's they have no place. They're sleeping in their cars. They're sleeping on the street. I've even met students who are sleeping on the sidewalk outside of the classroom where they go to college. So it's a whole new level of challenge.
What's the impact on the ability to learn and study, which is the point of working your way through school in the first place?
Take the individual. I mean, this is such a difficult thing to go through, again, while you're just trying to do the right thing. And many of these folks, we discovered, are working. And they are getting financial aid. In other words, they've done everything they're supposed to do. And it's the prices today are so high and the wages at these low-wage jobs they work at are so low that they can't make ends meet. The other impact, I have to admit, is on the colleges that they enroll in. If you can imagine a community college that has sizable numbers of these students there, while at the same time receiving some of the lowest levels of state funding, you put the two together. Under-resourced students in under-resourced classrooms at colleges that are so vulnerable, and it's a real perfect storm.
Is there a tendency to discount these issues or ignore them once we're dealing with adults? Is there a tendency to kind of turn away and say, well, you're 20 now, you know, we're not going to worry about you?
Yeah, there is, and I'm a little mystified by it. It is as if there was this bright line that's been drawn that says, oh, you turned 18, you graduated from high school, your poverty is now your own problem. And it's kind of incredible. And the students that I've talked to have expressed this in a way that I think many of us would also be struck by. They say, look, we did the right thing. You told us to graduate from high school. You told us to enroll in community college. You didn't tell us that when we showed up there, there'd be no breakfast anymore. There'd be no lunch anymore. You would take away our Metro card. And our expenses would rise so substantially that the Pell Grant wouldn't get it done. And it makes very little sense. I mean, it wouldn't take very much for us to expand the National School Lunch Program, for example, into the nation's community colleges. This is not rocket science. We can do this.
It is very hard to look away from this new report that finds that 2/3 of community college students in the United States struggle with food insecurity. Sarah Goldrick-Raab is the author of that report. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
When it comes to graduation rates, minority student enrollment, and more, how do community colleges in your area measure up? You can visit thetakeaway.org/communitycollege to see our interactive map on more than 1,000 community colleges all across the country. Military commissaries are discount grocery stores offering low-priced food and other items for military service members and veterans. The prices are set by a formula, and it's the same for everyone everywhere across the country. Now, that program is funded by taxpayers for now, but lawmakers and the Department of Defense are looking at new ways to manage an old program. Dorian Marina is a reporter at KPCC in Los Angeles and the American Homefront Project, and he has the story.
It's a busy Saturday morning at the military commissary at Los Angeles Air Force Base. A sign by the entrance advertises the day's sales. Vine-ripe tomatoes, 79 cents a pound. Asparagus for $1.98. And green grapes for $1.50. Those deals and the convenience are what brings Corita Concon here to shop for her family. Today she holds a bag filled with ingredients for a special birthday dinner for her mom.
Oh, I'm making like a traditional Belizean dish. It's a fish soup with a coconut-based broth. And then I'm also making like a Korean-style beef dish for everybody else. So my mom gets her own special meal.
Concon says she's been coming to commissaries since she was a kid. It was part of growing up in a military family. Now her husband serves in the Air Force, and the commissary, along with other services at the base, is still an important benefit.
Military people, it's not like you can go, oh, I'm going to work extra hard and get a bonus today. You have a certain amount of money that you can make per rank. And so your money needs to get spread far. And also the gas is here, the gym is here. So I kind of just make it a one-stop shop for me.
Concon comes 3 times a week and spends about $100. She estimates she saves 30% on what goes into her cart compared to what she finds at nearby stores. That all adds up. $3.99. For decades, commissaries like this one operated under a simple model, the base cost of a good plus 5%. And that model was supported by federal dollars. Last year, that was $1.4 billion. But that's changing. Congress passed a bill last year to make commissaries more self-sufficient. Texas Congressman Mac Thornberry chairs the House Armed Services Committee.
It really helps to protect the commissary benefit if we can show our colleagues in Congress that the amount of taxpayer funds that has to be put into this system is being reduced.
Consumers will start to see changes this month or the next. The first is variable pricing. Christopher Burns with the Defense Commissary Agency says the goal is to allow commissaries to be more flexible.
The price in Hawaii and on the local market is different than the price in the Midwest. The prices in the Midwest are different in the Southeast.
Instead of one global price, the commissaries will follow seven different regions in the U.S. The agency hopes that will pave the way for the second big change, the introduction of a private label.
This will start to ramp up slowly in May, and at some point down the road, we hope to have 3,000 to 4,000 private label products on our shelves.
With both, Burns emphasizes what he calls the guardrails, meaning all these changes need to happen without cutting into baseline savings that military families count on. But it's still a big concern for some. Eileen Huck is a government relations deputy director at the National Military Family Association. From her view, the federal money for commissaries is well worth the cost.
The value that families get is much greater than the $1.4 billion that the Department of Defense spends. So it's actually money very well invested.
Plus, putting the reforms in place and keeping the benefit could be a tough order, says Laura Army, an economics professor at the Defense Resources Management Institute. It all really points to some bigger questions.
Is there a better way to do it? Do you give people more money and eliminate the commissaries entirely? Do you privatize them?
Back at the L.A. Air Force Base, Army veteran Marvin Zachary and his wife push a cart of groceries to their car.
I'm, the old school type. If it's not broke, you know, leave it alone.
I ask what he thinks of the reforms.
I'd like to maybe get the changes ahead of time. You know, try to get some feedback.
Zachary won't have to wait long, and that feedback for officials may come soon, too. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marino.
This story was produced by the American Homefront Project. It's a collaboration of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, KPCC in Los Angeles, and WUSF in Tampa, with funding from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the Bob Woodruff Foundation. It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick with you today. Mary Jennings Hagar served three tours in Afghanistan as an Air National Guard major. On her third tour, on July 29, 2009, she was shot down over enemy lines while on a medevac mission.
We were shot down in bad guy territory, and we were holding our perimeter, and we were being covered by these two beautiful Army helicopters, these little Kiowas, with no room for cargo or people, but they have great guns and recon pods. And they got us on the radio and said, hey, we're going to have to boogie out of town because we're bingo gas, bingo fuel, and we're out of bullets and rockets, so we're not going to be able to help you guys anyway. And they said, but we have a crazy idea. If we'll land next to you if you want to hang on. We'll take you out here. And so we said, that sounds better than being abandoned. And they landed and ran out, jumped on the skid, straddled the rocket pod mount and held on tight and, you know, covered their egress with my rifle.
Mary Jennings Hagar, or MJ, as she's known, was awarded the Purple Heart and the Distinguished Flying Cross with Valor Device, just the sixth woman in history to receive the DFC and only the second to receive it with that Valor Device. But her fight didn't end there. After her tour, MJ became the lead plaintiff in the ACL lawsuit challenging the military's combat exclusion policy for women. The policy was ultimately repealed by the Obama administration, paving the way for thousands of women like her to join combat ranks. But the road toward inclusion and equality in the military hasn't been easy. Take the recent scandal with the Marines, where it was discovered that men had been sharing nude photos of their female peers. Marine Corps Commandant General Robert Neller recently called on male Marines to do better by the women they fight alongside.
How much more do the females of our Corps have to do to be accepted? What is it going to take for you to accept these Marines as Marines?
Well, shortly after that scandal broke, John Hockenberry spoke with MJ Hagar about her experience as a woman on the front lines and her own experience with sexual assault. They're both part of her new book, Shoot Like a Girl, One Woman's Dramatic Fight in Afghanistan and on the Home Front.
I was approached by the ACLU to help them in their fight against the unconstitutional ban on women serving in combat roles. My stepdaughter had come to me actually literally the day before I got the phone call from the ACLU in tears, saying that someone had told her that she wasn't allowed to follow her dream of becoming a U.S. Marine because she was a girl, because that was a boy's job. And it sounds like a made-up story, but I looked at her and said, I don't know what yet, but I'm going to do something about that.
So many people in the military describe the security that they feel in that unit, regardless of gender, when the chemistry is right and everybody loves everybody else and you're going for broke.
Absolutely. You've probably seen it referenced in movies and such that when the bullets really start flying, then you don't end up fighting for the mission or fighting for your country. You're fighting for the person next to you. You know, the Air Force and my unit in particular, you know, I don't even think of it as they integrated me into the unit because I just was part of the unit. I never felt like I needed to be introduced and integrated into the unit. They do it right. They train us together. They hold, you know, all of us to the same standard. They don't treat us differently. They don't point out the fact that I'm a woman and I'm different or anything like that. So I think that's the key to successful integration without disrupting unit cohesion. You have unit cohesion problems when you throw people together who are untested and don't know each other. Mm. Because when you're in combat and the bullets are flying, you have to be able to anticipate the people next to you. You have to know their strengths and weaknesses. This person on my right side is a great marksman, so I don't have to worry about that. But this person on my left side is not a good marksman, but they're a good tactical thinker, so I don't have to worry about enemy movements on this side or whatever. You know, you have to be able to understand your own battlefield.
And so when you're a patient in a military facility, you're a completely different kind of target for, I guess, unit cohesion breaking down. You had a sexual assault in a context that had nothing to do with combat, right?
And nothing to do with the fact that I was a woman, honestly. A lot of people think of sexual assault as a classic movie and TV rape scene that is usually about sexual gratification. And in my experience and in the research that I've done, shows me that the sexual assault epidemic in the military, first of all, there are more victims that are men than women, and that's hardly ever talked about. But it's not the sexual gratification that you picture from the movies. It's more of a sense of entitlement. You know, I have power over you, so I should get to do whatever I want. And that was how it was in my situation.
Was it harder to survive that than it was to survive the crash in Afghanistan?
I would say that had a bigger impact on me than anything in my career. I left the Air Force when that happened to me and joined the Air National Guard because in the Guard, I could still be in the military. I could still fight for my country. I could still be a pilot, but I could also have more control over my life. I could pick where I lived. I could choose my own doctor. I could do those types of things.
Your little stepdaughter said she wanted to be a Marine and was told no and came to you crying.
Right.
Given that experience and all that that produced, what's your reaction to this Marine photo scandal business?
Yeah.
Naked pictures and
I think it's a great example of why we need to integrate women into combat roles, to be honest. And that's not a talking point. That is truly how I feel. I think it was Admiral Mullen, and at the time he was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who said that as long as we bar women from the most elite jobs in the military, then we create this duality in the military where there's like a warrior class and a support class. And until we open those up, even if no women are able to make it into those roles, but until the military leadership sends the message to the military in general that we're not going to bar people from applying for jobs based on their gender, which in other words is saying stop making decisions about how you treat people by their gender, we're going to have this cultural problem of just like I talked about with my sexual assault, where there's this sense of entitlement of, well, we're the guys taking the fight to the enemy, so you should thank us for our service and see how you can support us and what you can do for us. And if what you can do for us is let us post, you know, inappropriate pictures of yourself online, then we're going to do that because we have the right to do that because we're fighting for your freedom. And that's a very small group of people who feel that way, by the way. I don't think this is representative of the Marine Corps at all.
But it's the openness with everybody's a part of the culture that is the suppression mechanism for naked pictures and these impulses that are sort of testosterone.
I'm glad you brought that up because in my book I talk a lot about the first unit that I was a part of, and it was only one or two people who were openly discriminatory against me, but it was the people who watched it and turned away and started doing something else or didn't say something to defend me again that really broke my heart and made me feel like I wasn't part of that unit and then I needed to go find a different home. So Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps Ronald Green released a statement about this that I thought was brilliant. And it says, stand up, speak out, and be a voice of change for the better. Hold those who misstep accountable. We need to realize that silence is consent. Do not be silent. It is your duty to protect one another, not just for the Marine Corps, but for humanity. And that's absolutely true, that it is a very small number of people, percentage-wise, who feel like they have such a low opinion of women that they can do these things. They can post such horrible comments and pictures and degrade people, fellow Marines, you know. But it's this majority who's afraid to speak out. And I get it. I understand. I've gotten death threats for my work, and the person who broke this story has gotten death threats. So it's not a comfortable thing to do, to stand up for what's right. But the more of us who do it, the fewer people are going to be able to intimidate others into silence.
What about the experience of being in the military do you miss that surprises you the most?
You know, I would say that it's the camaraderie. I think the camaraderie I miss, but I'm not 100% sure the camaraderie was what I thought it was, to be honest with you. I felt very much accepted and like the guys and women that I flew into combat with, I would take a bullet for and they would take a bullet for me for the most part, especially in my last unit. But to be honest with you, ever since I've started this journey, I have had a lot of people threaten me, not people that I knew, but like strangers. And I've experienced a surprising lack of people standing up and defending me. They send me private messages and say, oh, that was horrible what that person said to you, or good for you for standing up against that person. But they don't put themselves out there as much as I would have thought they would have. Although I have to be honest, that's probably been my experience my whole life. I've always been someone who didn't really, and I don't know that it's a compliment to me, but that's probably not very smart, that I usually step out and say something when something's not right, and I've suffered some consequences from that. And I've noticed that not everybody's like that. So I do miss the camaraderie, but I'm not sure. I may miss what I thought was the camaraderie. I definitely miss the adrenaline, although I'm a mom of little kids now, so I'm trying to resist the temptation to buy another motorcycle and get back into that.
Mary Jennings Hagar, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Mary Jennings Hagar is an Air Force veteran and author of Shoot Like a Girl, One Woman's Dramatic Fight in Afghanistan and on the Home Front. She spoke with John Hockenberry.
Long inbound. Harden with the catch. The finish.
They go over the top. Tip by Graham. Clock expires. And for the first time in school history, Davis is dancing.
Jacksonville State is going to the big dance for the first time.
To many of us, the middle of March means St. Patrick's Day or just 3 weeks from opening day for baseball. But for many, many more of you, the middle of March is March Madness. It's college basketball. And if you are like most people around our office, you got to get to work on that bracket. There are five teams making first-time appearances in this year's NCAA tournament. You got Northwestern, you got UC Davis. Of course, there are also the veteran squads like Villanova, UNC. Of course, you got Arizona in there. For most of us, filling out a good bracket is a fool's errand to begin with. But with all the analysis pouring in off the internet and from cable sports, especially from your friends, it can seem like an exercise sometimes in writing random college names on a chart. But first tip-off is Thursday at 12:15 p.m. Eastern, and that means that you need to get to work. And we've got the guru to help you win this year.
I'm Joe Gagliano, sports gambling expert, and
person that orchestrated and financed the largest sports scandal in history.
What he's talking about there is the Arizona point-shaving scandal. It was a sports bribery conspiracy involving the Arizona State men's basketball team during the 93-94 NCAA season. Gagliano talks all about it in his new book called No Gray Areas, and those fixing days are behind him, thankfully, and now he spends his time giving out advice on how to fill out those tournament brackets. Here are his top three tips.
My number one tip for the NCAA pools is not to be predictable. Everyone's going to have the usual suspects going all the way, whether it's the Elite Eight, the Final Four, or in the championship game. Everyone's going to have your Kentuckys, the Kansas, the Dukes, the Villanovas. So you're not going to surprise anyone. Where you're going to be different and where you're going to make your pool make sense is when you pick up all the cheap points in rounds one and two. The 5-12 matchups, the 6-11 matchups, the 7-10 matchups. So those are where you're going to pick up some points, and that's where you're going to actually be able to outperform other people inside your pool.
Well, it's not enough to be unpredictable, Gagliano says. You also need to look at each team's current playing history.
Pick teams that have momentum. Don't be afraid to take the lower-seeded teams. Look at the last five games that the teams have played. Don't lose track of the fact that these are 18, 19, 20-year-old kids. And although they're wickedly talented athletically, they're probably, for the most part, a little mentally unstable. If you get a team that has confidence behind them, even though they're in an inferior conference, but if they've got a whole bunch of momentum behind them and they're on a four-game win streak, five-game win streak, these kids just believe they could do anything at that point.
Of course, the key here is to have fun, but you also got to be smart about how you're betting.
If you're going to play it and you're going to gamble it and you're going to try to pick some winners, just don't play with the rent money. Just don't play with money that's going to make a difference in your life. Just play with what you need to have fun and to keep you interested and try to beat the other people inside your pool.
Well, there's some sound advice, hopefully, from Joe Gagliano, sports betting guru and former NCAA point-shaving fixer. And we're asking you all about the tournament. Are you filling out a bracket for the college basketball tournament? If so, do you have tips of your own?
Hi, I'm John from Wantagh, New York. For me, bracketology is all about the coolest mascots, especially if the team is like an 11th seed. At least that's what the boss's wife said as she took the entire office pool last year.
And this from Lima, Ohio, they say, pick Michigan. See, that's no kind of advice. Those are just your favorite teams. If you're not a fan of college basketball, there are always these great spinoff brackets that happen every year. We love the one at KPCC in Los Angeles. They have a bracket where you can match your favorite public radio shows. But what are some of your favorite spinoff tournaments that you can follow this time of year?
Hi, this is Jessica calling from Brooklyn. My husband and I actually did a bracket with our top 16 baby names when I was pregnant. So we seeded them in alphabetical order, and each name did battle against the names that were adjacent to it until we came out with a winner. And my husband's winner ended up being our winner.
This is Alan in Brooklyn, New York. Some brackets I've been following lately include the Trevor Noah bracket for Trump tweets and recently Bill Maher's brackets for worst congressman.
And here's a key question. What do you do if you're not a basketball fan, but you love someone who is?
Hi, my name is Melissa Coakley. I'm calling from Drake, Massachusetts. If you lose a loved one to March Madness, here are some things you can do. One, make sure you text your loved ones any important life events they miss while they're quote-unquote missing. This will help reorient them once they return. Two, cook your favorite food or order your favorite takeout, or you choose the movie. It's all about you until your lost loved ones return. Three, steer the ship. Make sure your lost loved one has food, water, and shelter, and see that their affairs are in order. Someone has to look out for the lost. Solidarity.
Call us with your predictions or your March Madness bracket tips or your favorite spinoff tournaments. It's 8778MYTAKE. You can always reach us on Twitter. We're at The Takeaway. And you can always reach me directly on Twitter. I'm at Todd Zwillick. You know, in this media landscape where everyone's been trying to burst out of their bubbles, get away from the coasts, get into the country a little bit, comedian Todd Barry says maybe everyone in the media got the idea from him.
I'm the reason they say that when you hear that. It's because they saw my tour dates.
Well, if he sounds familiar there, you might know Todd Barry from The Conan O'Brien Show or Louie, or as a character actor in films like The Wrestler or shows like Flight of the Conchords, and of course, his stand-up act.
You ever make plans with someone you do not want to hang out with, and then they cancel? Wow. That is about as joyous as life gets.
This woman actually said, and I quote, "I like Coke,
I hate Pepsi with a passion. And it made me very sad for her. Because her body is telling her that she hates something that tastes exactly like something she loves.
Todd Barry's been a veteran of the comedy scene for a long time, but over the last year, he's been trying to do less of the Madison Square Garden thing and instead travel to smaller towns and cities, the so-called secondary markets, places like Asheville, North Carolina, or Little Rock, Arkansas, Portland, Maine, or upstate New York. He got a good sense of what those places were about and what his act was all about in the context of those audiences. Todd Barry writes about all those experiences in the towns and their comedy clubs across America in his new book. It's called Thank You for Coming to Hattiesburg.
I'll play anywhere. I like playing anywhere. But I've always found it's kind of exciting to go to a city that you never would have thought of going to, like, you know, Toledo or something. And finding the good there and the fun. And you know, you don't always find fun. But I'm also not very fun. So that works out usually.
Well, what do you find to love about secondary markets? It's kind of pejorative, but you find something there to love that you hate about playing in big cities?
It's not that they're better. It's just that they are actually good. And they like the title comes from a phenomenon that happens. I first noticed when I played Fairbanks, Alaska, where people will just thank you for just actually showing up there. Like you do a show in Chicago, they don't go, I can't believe you came to Chicago to do a
right.
show. But if you go to Fairbanks or Hattiesburg or you know, Little Rock, they might be a little surprised because it's not like everyone's pouring through Little Rock.
Which one of these places kind of captured your comedian's heart?
Well, I did a show in Missoula, Montana, and you just get kind of crazy things that happen that aren't necessarily going to happen in a bigger place. Like a guy was paying me after my show in Missoula. I looked at the figures and it was like he was drunk and the money didn't seem right. And I go, this doesn't seem right. And he's like, oh, yeah, as the show progressed, I started cutting deals. So that's it's like
what?
He's just like I'm cutting deals. Like it's just people like, hey, it's a $12 cover. What do you think? $9? Yeah, okay, let's do that. And it was just kind of offensive, but it's so wrong that it's hilarious.
That just means that all the people in Missoula know that this guy's a soft target. That
right,
he's a mark. That if you wait long enough to go to the door,
right.
you get 75% off.
He does the eBay route. It's just it's a bidding thing. I've had more than one falling down drunk person paying me. And it always cracks me up because, I mean, it makes me angry at the time, but I think they justify going, hey, it's, you know, I'm working in a bar, so, you know, there's alcohol here. It's like, well, you go to a liquor store and it's not like the salesman's drunk. It's weird because you could show up one place and they're just completely like welcoming and there's all this stuff spread out. Then there's others where you're like, did you know that I was coming here tonight? Like that place in Missoula, there was like Taco Bell wrappers in a storage room, and that was my quote-unquote dressing room. And I asked for a bottle of water, and it was just, you'd think I'd ask for, like, some cookie that you can only get in Sweden or something, because they're like, wow, water, water. Yeah, I feel like someone must have asked you for water at some point in your promoting career. But
then again, maybe not. Maybe it's just a function of a Dixie cup and a faucet. I mean,
right.
That's what it should be.
I mean, the guy actually, at some point after going on a search for water, had a bottle of water that he's been drinking, and he kind of waved it at me. Hey, you want this? No, I think I'll find another source.
So I'm really curious. You know, you've been on the stage at Madison Square Garden. You've opened for Louis C.K. in front of something like 14 or 15,000 people.
Uh-huh.
Is there a joke that works at Madison Square Garden that just doesn't work in Hattiesburg? Have you experienced that?
When you do something like Madison Square Garden, like I don't have a lot of experience playing that size place, you kind of keep it a little bit tighter just because there's not a lot of time to just meander if I'm headlining. But also, I mean, what it does do, and the experience did help me, is that it's always a funny point of reference to go, you know, 3 nights ago I was on stage at Madison Square Garden and tonight I'm at Juanita's Cantina in Little Rock, and
right.
just to see the difference. But it's also interesting because it was almost like it's on some level it's easier to play to 14,000 people than it is sometimes to play to a small crowd.
I mean, is comedy, I don't know if scarier is the right word, but is it harder, you know, when you can see the whites of their eyes?
I like to face the enemy, as I like to say it. But like I know, like Louis likes to perform pitch black, not see anyone. I always have them, if I can, raise the house lights up a bit so I can see them. I just, something about, I feel more connected to them. It seems counterintuitive because it seems like it'd be more scary to see them.
Yeah.
But if you see a couple of people smile and that sort of goes, okay, well, this is might be going well.
Has your act changed since November and the election? I mean, we have this conceit, right, that everybody wants to get out of the East Coast, get off the edges of the country, get into the heartland where real Americans are, and you've done that. Is that a real thing? Has your act changed or your outlook changed since November?
I mean, I never have done – I mean, I'm not a dumb guy, but I'm also not a great political mind. So I kind of stayed – I've always steered clear of that kind of joke. So it hasn't really – you know, it affects my conversations with people off stage. It hasn't really changed what I talk about on stage, unfortunately. I'm not very deep is what I'm saying.
Elections happen, political revolutions, you know, still jokes about flying, basically, the red eye.
I mean, yeah, it's just we need that too in this world.
All right, well, forget about politics. I mean, we all want to be heard, and you've gone to what are called secondary markets, smaller cities. You've been heard. You've been appreciated there. The media is dying to do this, right? They're dying to get heard and trusted in places like Hattiesburg. You have any advice?
One thing I talk about a number of times in the book is people's perceptions of these kind of markets. Like I mentioned this, that I on Facebook I posted that I was doing a show in Little Rock and someone wrote, well, that's a tough crowd for your sharp wit. And it's like, the show hasn't even happened yet. How do you know it's a tough crowd? It's like, you already know it's going to be a tough – I don't know it's going to be a tough crowd. But this Facebook friend of mine does. It's just a perception that it's going to be, you know, just rednecks or something. And it's just not true. And there's people everywhere and there's public radio everywhere. And there's – and even if you go to a red state, there's also – there's still enough, you know, progressive people to show up and be cool.
Well, before I let you go, Todd Barry, I need a little bit of personal therapy. This is a point this is a point of personal privilege.
That's going to get good now.
From one Todd to another, do you hate it? I got to be honest. I hate my name, and I have told my parents this, that Todd has wound up being the name of every annoying, way too rich, way too white villain in every movie, and it's Todd.
And I'm getting really sick of guys named Todd.
Hi, girls.
Whoa, it's Todd.
Who's that with them? That's not you. That's Todd.
Are you with me on this?
I would say, if this makes you feel better, I feel like Chad is probably more lampooned name than Todd.
I'm not saying it can't get worse.
Or Skyler or Tyler or
okay.
Yeah, I mean, I don't. It's a solid name, don't you think? It's just kind of. Or you could change it. What's your middle name?
See, that's the thing. I don't have one.
You don't
and
have
I'm,
a middle name?
And I'm hanging out to dry. No, I don't even have a go-to for a middle name.
Oh my God!
I'd have to get completely original.
Then get one of those baby name books and have at it.
And have at it. I'll get back to you on that. Todd Barry, my fellow Todd, who apparently does not labor at all under the tyranny of his name, is author of Thank You for Coming to Hattiesburg. Todd Barry, it's been a great pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by New York Presbyterian, proud sponsor of public media. Dedicated to providing care for New Yorkers and research to benefit patients everywhere, amazing things are happening here. More at nyp.org/amazingadvances. LegalZoom, helping small business owners get started with a small business startup kit, which includes educational ebooks and other resources. More information available at LegalZoom.com/startup. By Staples, with copy and print solutions for small business, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, and custom framed prints and posters. More at Staples stores or staples.com. Staples, make more happen.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.